Welcome to the official podcast of the Marriott Student Review, where we connect the leaders of tomorrow with the issues of today.
Hey listeners, this is Anna Gazdick. I want to start today's podcast by reflecting on 2017. Think for a moment about the hashtag MeToo movement, the emergence of the silence breakers, and the accusations against Harvey Weinstein and Matt Lauer. These events shocked our nation, and they triggered a huge social movement that turned national attention and conversation to sexual assault. Today's podcast is going to center around sexual assault in the workplace. Our guests today are Wyatt and Christine Pagano, and they're ready to talk about what this social movement has to do with the business world and how HR leaders can help end sexual assault in the workplace. Thanks for coming, Wyatt and Christine. Christine, would you like to start by introducing yourself, and then we can go to Wyatt?
My name is Christine Pagano. I am the Director of Sexual Assault Services at a nonprofit organization called the Center for Women and Children in Crisis. And our mission is just to provide a safe and educating and advocating atmosphere for the community, for survivors of domestic violence, and for sexual assault. And we partner with many organizations and agencies, police agencies, government agencies throughout Utah County to provide these services.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Wyatt.
I am the lucky man who's married to Christine Pagano. And we've known each other for about 5 years or so now and been married for about a year and a half. And we've had a lot of opportunities during our marriage to be able to get together and partner. And I get to volunteer with her organization often. I currently am a senior at Brigham Young University, studying business management with an emphasis in organizational behavior and human resources. We're looking forward to future opportunities. Grad school for me, Christine is currently working on her master's degree in social work, so she's a big inspiration for me on that. And we just love life.
That's us.
Welcome. We're so excited to have you guys today.
Thank you.
So Christine, we kind of want to talk to you today to better understand this issue and the background of it. So can you first give us just a quick summary of what you do and your role as a director?
Definitely. So as a director of sexual assault services, I coordinate, obviously, crisis intervention for sexual assault survivors in three different counties. So at the beginning, that begins with crisis intervention. We run a 24-hour hotline that they can call in and get information. A lot of times it's just helping survivors know that they have been assaulted. They're experiencing all these emotions and they don't know what to trace it back to. So we provide that crisis intervention. We then meet them at hospitals throughout the community to be there with them while they go undergo a forensic exam to gather evidence and to just make sure that they're okay. From that point, we help them find resources that are going to be beneficial for them. So therapy, a police advocate, we link them to other resources to help them get money to pay for therapy and things like that, so that the sexual assault is not this overwhelming event in their life that has a negative impact for the rest of their life. So the quicker you can get a survivor resources, the better that healing begins.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Can you just describe maybe what sexual assault is? What defines sexual assault?
Yeah, so sexual assault is basically any unwanted sexual physical contact without the explicit consent of obviously the victim. So that can be multiple different things. It's kind of the umbrella term. Sexual assault, meaning it can be forced sexual intercourse, which is rape. It can be forced sodomy, incest, child molestation, using an object. It can be anything that has a sexual connotation to it. And then obviously there's also sexual harassment, which is the verbal coercion.
How are women best able to confront this problem and overcome it? What empowers or enables them?
Well, I think, first of all, as a society, we need to admit that it happens to men as well. The statistic is 1 in 5 women nationally and 1 in 6 men nationally. So there really is no difference.
Wow. Yeah.
There's just more of the societal view that it happens to women more. So, yes, it does happen to women more often, and men are more often the perpetrators, but it does happen to men. It's harder for them to define and to admit. So we have to take that into consideration. But then to follow through that, it affects a survivor's life in every single aspect. And I think a good question to really define that is how does a sexual assault not affect a person? it really does touch home in every single aspect of a survivor's life. It affects their work, whether it happened at work or it was perpetrated by a coworker. It affects their marriage, their partnership, their family life, their comfort levels, their coping skills. It really touches on everything. And that's something that society hasn't quite accepted yet.
If you could change how society views or confronts this issue, how would you change it? What would you recommend?
The Me Too movement really brought it up to attention. The Me Too movement, the Time's Up, the No More movement. It's really been brought to attention that this is a problem. And what's largely contributed to this is this idea of rape culture, where people are objects, specifically women. You can see it if you just Google rape culture and look at images. Thousands of images will pop up where women have been objectified to sell food, to sell clothing, shoes, accessories, you name it, it's been sold by a woman's body. And that is where the problem is. It's in media, every aspect. So this rape culture has then moved into this society where we say, oh, but it's a victim's fault. You know, what was she wearing? What was she drinking? What was he doing? All of these things which blame the victim. So to say, for society to say women and men are just objects for use, to then transition it into, but what were you doing? It's your fault that you were assaulted. There's this confusion, and that needs to be solved for sexual violence to lessen.
White, let's turn to you for a little bit. So you wrote an article last year. It's entitled How HR Leaders Can Help in Sexual Violence Against Women. And this was published in the Merit Student Review. Why did you choose this topic?
I think the biggest reason I chose this topic was because I've seen the devastating effects of sexual violence on women. I've seen the tears. I've seen it. And it's something that doesn't get talked about, at least not until recently. And it's something that, unfortunately, many, many, many people are very ignorant of it. And it's an uncomfortable subject. I think a lot of people see it as something that is taboo. Nobody wants to talk about it. It's not pleasant. It's very dark. And I think that that's part of the problem, though, is that we don't talk about it. Like many issues, like many addictions, for example, pornography addictions or other types of things like that, they thrive in the dark. They thrive when people try to ignore them and shove them under the rug and don't talk about them. And so I think that opening that dialogue and making it a priority in the minds of more people in more situations can go a long way to changing what we see.
So I think maybe when people first see this subject, they're a little bit confused about the link to maybe the business industry or the workplace. So there's a national statistic that says that 20% of women have been sexually assaulted. That means that if a head of a company is looking at his or her female employees, 1 in 5 of them have been sexually assaulted. And in your article, you write that sexual violence against women is a problem that belongs to everyone. So what does that mean in terms of a business?
Well, I could see how maybe for some people, they may look at my article and wonder, how can business really get involved with this? Isn't that a bit of a stretch? But we spend so much of our lives at work. I mean, think about it. If we spend at least 30% of our waking hours daily at work. And when you go through things that are so difficult, it will affect your work. And this is a good thing, but women everywhere, and men too, are having the courage to start speaking up about what's going on and what's happening to them. And this is a good thing. It's important. But it also means that now businesses are going to have to confront issues with their own employees. They're going to have to confront issues with things that happen at the workplace. And they're probably also going to need to be concerned about what employees do outside of the workplace.
To bounce off a little bit more off of what Wyatt has said, is 93% of sexual assault survivors experience PTSD. That rate is higher than veterans, people who experience natural disasters, freak accidents, 93%. So if you take the symptoms of PTSD and then compare them with a business aspect, they're going to be way less productive at work while they're dealing with anxiety and depression and some of these other things. So it is what happens at home definitely influences what's happening in the workplace, especially with, you know, 86% of the perpetrators being known to the victim. But it's just the concept of power becomes terrifying to victims and to survivors, whether it happened at work or it didn't. It's just that opportunity of being victimized again, perhaps in a workplace, by someone who's not trying to abuse you, but has power over you, will terrify you so you don't go to work. And then what happens to productivity?
Yeah, I mean, that is definitely one element of it. If I would encourage listeners to download my article, either from our website, the Marriott Student Review website, or BYU Scholars Archive, you can find it there, or even if you just Google it, it'll probably be the first thing that pops up. But I recommend downloading. There are a couple of things that I talk about. It's about specific things that survivors of assault deal with and have to manage, which can affect their workplace. One of those is trust and relationships. That is something that is a huge problem. When sexual violence occurs, it is a violation of trust and of their own personal autonomy. And so it can be much more difficult to have trusting relationships with people that you work with, which is extremely important for businesses to reach the results, have good outcomes. You don't trust people that are in positions of authority because you don't know what they might do to use that authority against you. And as strange as that may sound, and it may seem irrational, but these are the realities for people who've been through this, is those are things they feel and they cannot help it.
So Wyatt, in your article, you bring up four ways that HR leaders can help end sexual violence in the workplace. So these are culture, education, policy, and benefits. So can you just quickly take us through these four steps and explain what they are and what they mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess this really kind of gets to some of the meat. That's the, you know, the part two of my article was,
right.
First one is understanding the issue. Second half was, now what can HR do about it? And one of the things that's, you know, it's a buzzword of HR, it has been for a long time, it will be probably forever, is culture. Culture, essentially defined, is the attitudes, beliefs, and values that help define what kind of behaviors are acceptable and appropriate within a workplace. But it's powerful as far as how people act and behave at work. And many people take that home with them. And so my element is we have to start looking at having a culture in our workplace that is concerned about the well-being of the women who are there. And what I think that really comes down to is, in our workplace culture, do we recognize not just the value of our women, but do we care about their well-being and their happiness? If I have a woman coworker that tells me that she's been sexually assaulted by one of the other coworkers, am I going to believe her? And I think that is the big thing with culture, is we have to make a shift in our beliefs to where we say we are going to believe women that say this has happened. We're going to start by believing. So starting with that, I think, is going to be really important, because that's how we really will move into that value of the safety of the women in our workplace is paramount. And we say women here. I know that there are men, but that's kind of the emphasis of my article, is more focused on women. And then in the artifacts, that comes out in, so what do we do when something like this comes up? And even if, you know, a manager or a boss never has anybody come and tell them this information, do we engender a culture of, we're going to care about you and do that? And so I think culture is a really important place to start. And that can be reflected in a lot of different ways. I think my wife has something she wants to say. Go ahead, honey.
Well, as Wyatt's been talking about culture, let's bounce back to that idea of rape culture.
Yes, absolutely.
And
it's right there, yeah.
You know, just think of what could have happened had an HR or an advertising executive say, hey, we're not going to tie that woman up and have four or five men who are all oiled up and muscular ripping at her clothes when we're advertising a shoe.
Yeah.
Hey, we're not going to do that. right? Because not only does it objectify the women, but it objectifies the men. And that is rape culture, right? So think about how that can be changed within a business if someone just said, hey, we're not going to do that. Or if they overhear a coworker talking about something that they did, or, you know, a stereotypical joke, or trivializing rape or sexual assault, if they just stepped in and said, hey, that's not acceptable to this company, that's not our culture, and put an end to it, that would influence society significantly.
Absolutely. I don't think I could have said it better myself, and I think that's really, as often she does, my wife has a great way of clarifying my thoughts on these things.
That's why he married me.
Absolutely. But that's really the heart of it. If you want to, like she said, if you Google image things, you'll find things from Arby's or Burger King that are extremely sexually suggestive. And while they're a little old, you know, maybe from the last, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, other stuff isn't so old, including Carl's Jr. commercials.
Right.
Many people will remember the Carl's Jr. commercials where it was always about the sensual eating of the sandwich. Then do you have the HR person who sees this stand up to whoever is doing that and say, this is not acceptable. This is not our culture. That is not who we are at, you know, company XYZ. And there's some elements with that. Changing culture is not an easy thing. Culture is a very ingrained organizational issue, and that's why we talk about it all the time. I would recommend that people interested in changing culture this way study a little bit of Harvard professor John Kotter, talk and look into his 5 steps for change management. And I may talk about this a little bit later, but I'd like to finish the question that you mentioned previously. So education, policy, and benefits for me would be the artifacts of this new culture, right? So education is super important. One of the things that HR can do is training about these kinds of issues. And it could be a yearly training, but something that talks about, and they ask the questions you ask, what is sexual assault? What constitutes that? And be very, very clear about what that it is a crime, and to educate people about what victims go through. Because what they go through is, I mean, it is the deepest circle of hell for many of these people. And having that understanding and creating that empathy for what they suffer from the thoughtlessness or, you know, just the inhumanity at the hands of another human being can do a lot to help people think about their own behavior, right? And you can discuss things like manipulation, coercion, and all those things that often lead to it, and discuss healthy relationships, what constitutes abusive relationships, and get that dialogue going to where people are talking about it. So educating people about the issue is something HR can do. We talk about sexual harassment in the workplace, sure. We talk about what the rules are. You know, if we say you're not allowed to be using recreational drugs in the workplace and tell people what are recreational drugs, we should be able to have these kinds of conversations as well.
Right. And ultimately, education is empowerment, right? And I think what a large part of why its article is based off of is we are not empowering anyone by not talking about it in the workplace, right? By saying what happens at home or what happens to you personally doesn't belong in the workplace. Without a doubt, whenever I give a presentation or I teach someone about what sexual assault and rape constitute, I have a disclosure. Because it's people who are sitting there who think, oh my gosh, I was assaulted and I had no idea. And these feelings that I've been having for years and I've been struggling with
depression,
are a result,
anxiety,
of sexual assault and of rape. And I think there's a lot of power that HR professionals can bring to the table when they stand up and give a presentation and say, hey, this doesn't make you weak. This doesn't make you a wrong, terrible person. If you're experiencing any of these, please come and have a conversation with me. I'd like to get you resources.
Mm-hmm.
That's all that would require to open the gate to education.
Absolutely. And it allows work to become a safe place for somebody who spends a lot of their life after an event like this wondering where they can be safe.
Right.
So the next point of this is that you brought up is policy. The way policy can come in is, are we going to tolerate this kind of behavior from our people? You know, maybe coming back to culture. Culture is very powerful in this way. If you can have a culture where if some guy is making crude remarks about, you know, the woman in the cubicle next to him, to have somebody and say, hey, man, that's not cool. Googlers don't do that, you know, or LinkedIners, or I don't know what everybody calls themselves these days, right? But
right.
And not that necessarily Google or LinkedIn have those problems, but just, you know, any company can say, we at this firm do not talk like that about women. And if you can do that, that will be extremely powerful. But inevitably, there's going to be people who don't listen. And so this is where policy comes in, is what are you going to do if that female employee comes to you and says, coworker, you know, John Doe assaulted me and here's what happened. What are you going to do? We already talked about starting by believing and saying, okay. Now, this doesn't mean you automatically condemn John Doe, but it does mean you take her very seriously. So the policy that I recommend is if somebody comes and reports this, you need to be investigating it immediately.
Right.
You need to have a policy in place to start providing benefits and resources for victims, which I'll get to in a moment. And what are you going to do about the person involved? I recommend that if there is a coworker that has been accused of sexual assault, that you would consider, at least with a, you know, whether they're looking at pornography and women are seeing them doing that in the workplace, maybe something more minor like that, one warning. I'm one warning, one strike. You do it again, you're out of here.
Right.
I propose a very strong zero tolerance policy for that kind of behavior, including sexual harassment verbally. We may let it slide one time. You mess up again, you're gone. No exceptions. And I would also recommend that if somebody's accused of, you know, the serious forms of assault, actual physical assaults, rape, and that sort of thing, it might be wise for companies to consider putting them on probation or suspension from their employment until they get a chance to really go through an investigation and decide how to proceed from there. Naturally, these things, you want to consult a company's legal team as you go through this stuff and make sure that things are okay. But I would consider starting at that point, because that helps reinforce the messages that you send in your culture about we don't tolerate this kind of stuff.
Right.
And I know there are some people out there who might be concerned that, well, what kind of power does this give women? You know, does this mean that any woman who has a beef with one of her coworkers will go to her boss and say, oh, he assaulted me? Doesn't happen. Maybe my wife would like to talk about false reporting real quick in this.
Yeah,
issue.
So, and that, as we've seen in the last year, that suspicion has been brought up quite a bit of, right. Oh, these are just women who are revengeful or who know they can get some money out of this really wealthy guy.
Or want attention.
Or had it want attention. Or, hey, maybe they even just had bad sex and they regret it. When in reality, the false report rate puts it somewhere between 2 to 8%. Which is no different than any false reporting rate for any other crime. So someone who's claiming that they've been sexually assaulted and victimized by rape are not more likely to say that than someone who had their car stolen. It just doesn't happen. Right. What you go through as a survivor and as a victim of sexual assault, there's no way that you would try and do that to yourself on purpose, right? There might be one or two people here and there. But overall, as a society, that's not happening. And as an additional side note to what Wyatt was talking about with policies, oftentimes what happens is we have these companies and government agencies and households and whatever that bring a victim into a room with the perpetrator and say, tell us what happened. And here you have a victim sitting right next to the person who's hurting them, who's probably been threatened, who's probably been manipulated and groomed and all of these things, to then say, yes, this person did this to me, is horribly untrauma-informed, if that's even a word, meaning that you have that is not what a person who's experienced trauma will do, even if it happened. They won't do that. Their brain will not allow it. It will re-traumatize them. So part of that policy change could say, okay, we don't meet with both parties to get a he said, she said. We meet with them separately to get, tell us your full account, and then tell us your full account. So there's just little things that can be more trauma-informed in the workplace to make it a safer place for a survivor to disclose.
Plus, the last thing I would add to that is I think we need to have a little more faith in our female coworkers. That kind of brings us to the last point on that, which is benefits. So we realize as an HR person, this person has been hurt. They need therapy. They need support. They're in trouble. Many of those who are assaulted often miss work in the days, a lot of work in the days and weeks following an assault as they're trying to get their brain back on their shoulders and trying to pick up the pieces. And so thinking about that, I'm not promoting necessarily that companies need to dip down into their pockets and finance everything for every one of their employees that's been assaulted. But even something as simple as having HR leaders that know local resources, are they aware of local organizations that help with this issue? Nonprofits such as the Center for Women and Children in Crisis here in Orem, Utah. Are they aware that these things exist so they can say, I'm so sorry to hear that. I'm sorry you went through this thing. Here are organizations you can talk to that can help you and help you start your healing. Something like that can go a long way for people. And I would add that while this is on the rise, mental health benefits can be hugely important. Therapy is expensive. Cheap therapy is $125 a session, $125 an hour out of the pocket of these employees. Not a lot of people can afford to pay that. Mm-hmm. And so providing good mental health benefits with your company's insurance plans can make it easier for those who need help to get it. And this could be somebody who's a 55-year-old man and who's shut out memories for years and realizes that when he was 5 years old, he was molested by an uncle. So those are the four main things that I suggest HR leaders can do.
And I think that the most important takeaway from this is that it would not take extra money or resources to provide these benefits. For example, a lot of the clients that we work with, they have a hard time taking an hour out of their day, an hour and a half for travel, maybe 2 hours, out of their day to come and get therapy. Right? They don't want their employers to know. They don't want their coworkers to know. They don't want it to be announced that, oh, Jane Doe gets to leave every Monday for 2 hours because she has sexual assault therapy. That's not something that we want to advertise. But if it's just understood that if you need to leave for a 1 hour appointment with therapy for a mental health issue, that's your right as an employee.
Right.
There's no if, nay, say, or buts about it. That's just your right as a human. And that would not put any extra effort on a company financially. In fact, it would probably make an employee more productive to have what they need to thrive.
So I guess lastly, looking at perhaps management or employees or just Christine people in general who maybe feel like this isn't an issue that needs to be brought into the workplace or dealt with, or who don't want to make a change in culture, how do you deal with that as an HR person?
That's a great question. And to start that, I think I would again refer people to start looking at the steps for leading change. They could also look at a wonderful textbook out there on organization development. And man, like I said before, change is not easy, but the first step is create a sense of urgency. Doesn't matter what the power relationship is, you find a way to make it a front page issue for them. And whether that's your leaders or your subordinates, make it a front page issue by creating a sense of urgency. And I would say, look at the Weinstein Company. This has been in the news 100, every week, everyone's been talking about this, but here's something I've noticed. Not only did this issue of sexual assault get ignored by the leaders of the Weinstein Company, that not only did it just lead to Harvey Weinstein being kicked out of the company and, oh no, now we don't have funding and, finances are bad and now we're really struggling. I mean, this issue absolutely destroyed the company and its reputation completely. And here, for those of who might be older listeners, here's the Paul Harvey part of the story. It's that nobody wants to touch it with a 10-foot pole. How many times have they been really close in the news media, really close to some other company buying it out and saving it from utter, just absolute bankruptcy and ruin? Multiple times, and every single time the company backs off. And I think it's because the good people out there, even the smartest business people who say, hey, we might be able to make a know, we might be able to make a decent buck on this acquisition. They look at it and have to think about it and think, I don't want to touch that issue. I don't want that anywhere near us. I don't want that to come anywhere near tarnishing our brand. So that would be my first thing is, you don't want to talk about it, then let's talk about Weinstein. Or however people want to pronounce it. I'm pretty sure it's Weinstein.
I have no idea. I need to look it up.
But I'll start with there. So create a sense of urgency and get someone in power on your side.
Okay.
It may not be the CEO, but if you can get a CHRO on your side, or even a chief finance officer, or get somebody who, you know, can throw their weight around on your team and to be rooting for what you're trying to change and make that change. After you get somebody on your side, create a vision. People love vision. Get something that people can stand behind. Get a hashtag MeToo movement, your own version of it, going in your company. You know, or a hashtag no more. You know, hashtag Google. We just love the big companies around here near Silicon Slopes, so I'm going to just gonna throw out their names. So do that. Get that vision going and communicate that vision effectively through the trainings that I talked about and of education. Talk about it. Make it a front page issue for everyone then in the company. So you've got urgency, you've got power, you've got a vision, you're communicating that vision. And as you see those changes take place, make it easy for people to make those changes.
An example of this that we can see recently has been the response to all of the school shootings and to gun control. And we have all of these big name companies making a stand. Against gun violence and or in favor of more gun control or in favor of not
of
changing
less
gun control.
Control. Yeah.
So we see all of these big companies have all of these very emotional responses. Well, what would happen if you were to tell the CEO of these companies, you have six daughters, pick a daughter that you want raped, because one in four women, girls, are raped by the time they're 18. Pick your daughter. Which one do you want? If you drive it home to them like that, I guarantee you we would see a change. More women and men fall victim to sexual assault than guns will ever kill in this country, ever. But it doesn't have that same horrifying feel to these companies. And if we can change that aspect and we can make it personal to these companies, to these middle management, to whomever it may be, then we'll see the same response that we're seeing right now with gun violence.
So just to close, anything else you would like to add or you would like to say to our listeners?
Yes, actually. Although if you want to add something, honey, I'll let you go first.
I think the only thing that I would first like to add is thank you. Because whenever we can get a podium to speak and to educate the public about what's really going on, we take that opportunity. So thank you for having us. And then to anyone who out there who has not disclosed, there are safe places for you. We believe you and we will stand with you.
Well said, honey. The thing that I would say is let's take a stand and think about the women that you cherish in your lives. Think about your mothers, your grandmothers, your sisters, your aunts, your best friends that are girls. Think about your daughters or your nieces and think about the kind of life you want them to have. There are too many women are raised in this world to be afraid of walking in the dark at night. There is not a single woman out there who does not think, I should probably not be out here by myself at night. And the fear is not being mugged. The fear is not murder. The fear is rape. What kind of life do we want to give them? What kind of life do we want them to have? Think about that. And let's make this world and our workplaces where we spend so much of our lives a healthier and safer place for the women in our lives.
I'd like to repeat Wyatt's words one last time. Sexual violence against women is a problem that belongs to everyone. Whether HR leaders or not, let's pledge to be the change in our own spheres of influence by promoting an open and healthy culture of respect towards both men and women. I hope that you all were able to learn something with this podcast today. I was so enlightened and I think inspired by both Christine and Wyatt. If you want to learn more about this topic, I invite you to read Wyatt's article in the fall 2017 issue of the Marriott Student Review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.